On October 3rd, 2016, the Walker County Sheriff's Department responded to a 911 call from a home in rural Flintstone, Georgia, a little past 1 in the afternoon. According to the caller, a man had grabbed a shotgun and shot himself in the head. The police arrived and found two people outside the trailer, and inside, they found 27-year-old DJ Ficky deceased on a love seat. But due to constantly changing stories from witnesses, investigators became suspicious that this was actually a potential homicide. When the DA declined to press charges, DJ's sister Amanda began her own campaign to seek justice for DJ. I'm Charlie, and this is Impact Statement. When a crime ends in a conviction, the victims or their families are often allowed to give a statement to the court about the impact of the crime on their lives. But when these life-altering events go unsolved, do not end in a conviction, or maybe aren't crimes at all, the victims and their families do not have this opportunity. The stories on this podcast are their impact statements. Donald Ficky Jr., known as DJ to his friends and family, was born in 1988 to father Donald Sr. and mother Kathy. He was the only boy of four siblings. Donald Sr. died when DJ was just 14 years old, and that loss was incredibly hard on DJ. Here's DJ's sister Amanda telling me more about him.
So we all grew up together. We were a very close family. We did everything together. DJ was always a prankster. He was always picking on people. He was always aggravating people, just playing jokes on them. He was annoying. He would, aggravate you so bad. But it was in a funny way, in a, playing, playful way. Always making you laugh. You couldn't ever be in a bad mood with him around you. Even if it was his worst day in the world, It was like he took it upon himself to make you feel better. I mean, everybody had to be in a good mood around DJ.
DJ had a son born in March of 2014. And then in August 2014, he married Brandy, his son's mother. Then in June of 2015, Brandy had their twin daughters. Things were not always good with DJ and Brandy. Their relationship, even after their marriage, was on again, off again. A major issue in their relationship was drugs, meth in particular. In part due to their drug use, the children lived with DJ's mother, Kathy. At the time of his death, DJ and Brandy were living in Flintstone, Georgia, in Walker County. The property they were living at was owned by someone everyone called Old Man, and a number of people were living there, whether it was in the main trailer where Old Man lived, or a camper outside, or even a shed. In the camper lived a man that we will call Mike. We have been asked not to use his real name, and Mike is the name the 911 operator mistakenly calls him, so we will just go with it. When DJ and Brandy were off, Brandy had a relationship with Mike. Amanda characterized it as Brandy going back and forth between the two men. Two other people of note we will call Jacob and Christy. Again, we've been asked not to use their real names. The night before the shooting, they had stayed at the property, sleeping in their vehicle. According to those who stayed at the property, this was a drug house. They used drugs daily while staying in that home. DJ, though, was ready to leave this life behind and reunite with his children, but not without Brandy.
He was basically wanting to come back home to get out of there, everything. They were wanting to come back to my mom's house because that's where the kids were at. So they were, they were wanting to come back home to be with the kids. He had some drug issues, but he had went to rehab and he was trying to get help with that. And he was in love with Brandy. She was the world and he just couldn't stay away from her. He would always go back to try to get back with her, try to win her over. And he was just trying to get his family together. He was trying to come home.
A large part of maintaining sobriety after rehab is establishing a new social circle. the friends an addict makes while using are not the people someone in recovery needs to be around. But DJ wanted to be with Brandy, and Brandy was living at this property. And with this, DJ relapsed. Due to the changing witness stories of what happened that day, it's hard to know exactly what did happen. What we do know is that DJ was texting his mother from someone else's phone. Witnesses say that he and Brandy were fighting that morning, but in the text to his mother, DJ said he and Mike were fighting over Brandy. At 1:09 p.m., Kathy sent a final text to DJ. 3 minutes later, Mike called 911. The first 911 call was either dropped or Mike hung up on them. 911 called back and spoke to Mike again. The call again either dropped or Mike hung up. They called a third time. The second 911 call is hard to understand due to Brandy being very upset and near the phone yelling. But the first and third calls are the most important here. Here is the relevant portion of the first 911 call.
Walker, here we go. Okay, what's the problem?
We got a guy shot himself.
Okay, what did he shoot himself with?
A shotgun.
Okay, is he breathing?
It looks like it. I don't know.
How old is he?
I tried to get the gun, and it went off, and he had it in his mouth, and I was like, man, you know.
In case you couldn't understand that, Mike says he grabbed for the gun, and it went off. This is his first statement. And here is the third call. It is a different 911 operator who called back after the phone call was disconnected.
Mike, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
This is Walker County 911, okay?
911. Yeah.
Okay, Mike, listen to me, okay?
I will, because I get off it. Smart.
Okay, Mike, I need to talk to you. Can you give me your attention?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, the gun, where is it located now?
It's in the chair with him.
Okay.
I got the gun up and checked to see what it was. It was a 12 gauge.
Okay, so you moved the gun, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, can you secure that gun? Can you get it unloaded safely and lay it to the side out of the way?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, can you do that while I'm talking to you?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'll give you just a minute, okay?
I told me to get the gun and secure it.
No, don't shoot it. Secure it.
Don't shoot it.
Listen, Mike. Are you going to be the one doing it?
It ain't got anything but a single shot. It looks like it's fouled off.
Okay, so there's nothing in the gun at this point, correct?
No.
The gun is empty, correct?
No.
In that call, Mike said he touched the gun to see what it was. The 911 operator then instructed him to secure the weapon. This meant touching the gun and removing it from its resting position. When first responders arrived on the scene, they found Mike outside holding the shell casing and the gun inside on a shelf. The police officer then removed the gun and put it on a table on the porch. The first time Mike spoke to the police at the scene, his story already changed from what he had told 911. This time he claimed he came into the trailer around noon to take a shower, but Brandy was already in the bathroom. DJ asked to use his phone, and Mike gave it to him. He then went to a back room. While in the other room, Mike heard a gunshot and rushed into the room to find DJ on the love seat, covered in blood. He then called 911. He insisted it was only him, DJ, and Brandy in the trailer at the time of the shooting, and that he and Brandy were not in the room. But on the initial 911 call, he said he had grabbed the gun before it went off. This is the first major discrepancy. When Kathy was notified of the shooting while investigators were still at the scene, she informed them that she had just been texting DJ, and he said he felt his life was in danger. These texts read very much like a mother who has learned to put up healthy boundaries with her adult child. As much as I'm sure she wishes she could have done something to prevent what would come next, Kathy did what any loved one in her position should do. DJ was texting her asking if he could come back and live with her. She was facing her own health issues and an impending surgery. She told DJ repeatedly that she loved him, but no, he could not come live with her. DJ living with her would be something she was unable to handle at this point. She offered him ideas on where he could stay, including a place near her where he would be close to his kids. She gave him options, but she held firm. It was in one of these texts back and forth that he said he was going to end up dead if he stayed there. And that was the text Kathy alerted authorities to. Because of this information, Mike was asked to submit to a gunshot residue test. He agreed, but said he had shot guns the day before, which may affect the test. Gunshot residue only lasts on a living person for 4 to 6 hours, so he was told that it would not be detected from the previous day. And that's when Mike's story changes back. This time, he said what he said to 911. He was in the room when DJ had shot himself and had attempted to get the gun away from him when it went off. Brandy, however, was unable to give any statement at the scene, and it is clear she did not want to stay there.
She actually jumped in the vehicle with my husband and my mom when they arrived at the crime scene, wanting to leave with them. But my mom and my husband, not knowing what happened, they wouldn't let her, you know, leave with them because they didn't know what was going on. They didn't know what happened as far as her being involved or anything else. But she was wanting to leave with them that day. She didn't get to leave that day. They kept several of the witnesses that were there, kept her in the camper that night, and were telling her that she needed to stick with the story, that they knew where her kids were at, and they wouldn't let her use a telephone. The next day, she actually got a hold of the phone and called her aunt, and her aunt came and got her. And as soon as her aunt came and got her, she told her aunt everything that happened. And then her aunt called my mother and told my mother. And by the time that happened, it was too late in the afternoon to take her to the police station. So the next morning, as soon as they opened, we had her at the police station and she told them what happened.
The statement Brandy gave to police was that she had left the bathroom in time to see Mike come out of a bedroom with a sawed-off shotgun. He was angry. He put the gun up to DJ's face and fired. She also indicated for the first time that there were other people on the property at the time of the shooting, Jacob and Christy. Detectives went back to Mike, and now in a new statement, he said that Jacob and Christy were there, but had left the home before the shooting occurred. He again said he was in the back room. He first said he heard a bang, but quickly changed this to hearing Brandy yelling, entering the room to see DJ with the gun in his mouth. He could not remember if he tried to get the gun from DJ before DJ pulled the trigger. It would take several days to find Jacob and Christy. Jacob used a street name, and Brandy and Mike did not know his real name. He also did not have a fixed address, but they were eventually able to speak to both of them. Jacob told police that he was in the back room with two other people. DJ and Brandy had been fighting all morning. He heard Mike tell Brandy and DJ to shut up. DJ yelled something back, and Jacob left the back room to intervene in what he thought was a fight breaking out. DJ had the barrel of the gun in his left hand, and Mike had the handle of the gun in his right hand. And Brandy was telling Mike to stop and was pulling on his arm. When the gun went off, everyone ran out of the home. Jacob and Christy left because they did not want to be involved, but returned after police had arrived. At this point in the investigation, he and Christy backed up that DJ committed suicide. But it's clear, based on the investigative report, that the police were not going to drop it that easily. They continued to interview people who lived at the property, including re-interviewing and polygraphing Mike. On October 17th, Mike consented to the polygraph against attorney advice. The two primary questions were, Did you point that gun at DJ? And did you shoot DJ? He answered no to both. The examiner determined that deception was indicated on both questions. Mike's final story was now that he came into the room to see DJ pull the gun from the couch cushions. DJ intended on shooting himself, and Mike attempted to stop him. They struggled with the gun, at which time Brandy grabbed Mike's arm and the gun went off. On February 14, 2017, investigators re-interviewed Jacob, and he gave largely the same story, but with one major change. He said Mike was the one who pulled the trigger. Amanda then went to the jail where Jacob was to ask him herself what happened, and he largely repeated the story he told police in February. Amanda asked him the two most central questions in the case: who pulled the trigger, and was it accidental or on purpose? This is a recording from that conversation. Mike's real name has been edited out.
Was finger on the trigger when the gun went off?
Yes.
It was. Did DJ ever touch the gun and be honest with me, please?
Yes. He had his hand up on it. His left hand.
Was he trying to knock it out of his hand?
I don't know if he was.
Was he trying to block it?
It was so instantaneous when it went off compared to when I come through the door. I mean, it was like as soon as I come through is when the gun went off. But I couldn't see why he would be trying to make him put it up there, you know what I mean?
Right. Because from what we've been told, DJ threw his arm up like he was trying to block the gun. Maybe trying to, like, push
no,
it out of his face.
DJ, actually, he had his hand around the end of the barrel.
I mean, I've got the investigation report, and I've seen where you told him the majority of the truth on Valentine's Day, where you knew for a fact he had come out of that room with the gun and it cocked.
Yeah.
Do you feel like did it on purpose?
Honestly, no. I know he meant to intimidate him, but I really don't think he meant for the gun to go off like it did. I really don't.
Why didn't bring the gun up there that morning to begin with?
For intimidation. I don't think intended to shoot DJ. Like I said, he was just trying to scare him into shutting up because they've been arguing all day.
Who the hell points a loaded gun at somebody's face? I mean,
a dumbass.
Is he that stupid?
Yeah,
I mean,
he really is.
During the same interview, Amanda expressed concern for Jacob, both in being involved in the case, but also his ongoing drug problems. It's amazing to me that even as she's working on DJ's case, she takes the time to give some sisterly advice to Jacob on how he can turn his life around. She also expressed regret that Jacob found himself in the middle of this investigation. Jacob then said something quite interesting.
I was having to stay there at the time, and I was kind of, honestly, in the back of my mind, I thought he might have, you know, that if I told him 100% truth, that he might shoot me next.
This is a contradiction in what Jacob said that needs to be addressed. On the one hand, he's saying that he doesn't think Mike shot DJ on purpose because Mike isn't that type of guy. Yet he also said he didn't tell the truth about what happened initially because he was afraid Mike would come after him next. Amanda would later hire a private investigator, Eric Eccles. He also went to independently interview Jacob, and during this conversation, Jacob reiterates that it was not a suicide and gave a motive for why Mike brought a gun into the room.
So, brought the gun. Did he point the gun at DJ?
I didn't physically see him point the gun at him. When I come into the room, it was right as the shot went off, and yeah, had the gun in his hand.
And had the gun in his hand?
Yeah.
Okay. But
DJ also had a hand on the gun.
And then the gun went off accidentally?
Yeah, there was kind of, I don't know, what he called it, like a struggle or whatever, you know, and the gun went off.
Okay.
I don't think I meant to shoot DJ. It just happened that the gun was pointed directly at him, which he did point the gun at him.
Did point the gun at DJ?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think he meant to shoot him. I really don't.
So you think he meant to scare him?
Yeah, it was an intimidation.
Okay.
You know, trying to get him to shut up because him and Brandy wouldn't stop arguing.
Okay.
I'm not saying that DJ deserved to die because he really did.
Right.
but it was, didn't mean to shoot him.
So make sure I'm clear. Brandy was his wife.
Yes.
But also used to mess around with her.
Yes.
Okay.
Brandy had stopped that.
They had stopped that.
That was the agreement. That they wasn't messing around anymore, you know. And DJ was actually staying there with Brandy.
Right.
You know, and they was staying with his camper.
Okay.
And Brandy and DJ was together, so that's not the issue of why DJ got shot.
Okay.
It's because DJ and Brandy had been arguing for days, and everybody was tired of hearing it, and told them, you know, shut up, stop arguing, I'm tired of hearing it, da-da-da-da-da. And I don't know why he thinks in trying to intimidate somebody with a gun, because that's not what they're for, but...
Okay, so let me ask you this. After the gun went off, I read in the report that there was a story concocted to say that was suicide.
It wasn't necessarily a story concocted. It's just that's what was told, was that, you know, DJ tried to shoot himself and tried to stop him.
So that's what said.
Well, yeah, and I just kind of went along with it because honestly, I was kind of feared for my life.
What Jacob says is not backed up with the text DJ sent his mother. DJ's text said that he and Mike were the ones fighting, and that they were fighting over Brandy. So this leads the family to believe that the true motive was jealousy. We know there were four people in that room that day: DJ, Mike, Jacob, and Brandy. Jacob and Brandy both say Mike pulled the trigger. But in spite of that, the medical examiner ruled DJ's death a suicide. By hiring a private investigator to look at the case again, Amanda learned that while police seemed dogged in their pursuit of interviews, forensic evidence from the scene was not preserved, and communication between the investigators and the medical examiner was sorely lacking. Here is Eric Eccles, the private investigator.
The information that I got through the open records that I requested and looking at the police report, the case itself did not seem like it was a suicide. It seemed to me like it was a homicide. So, like I said, I did open records. I got information from the ME, got their report, their investigation, started looking at how the police did the investigation, how they did the crime scene, what the ME didn't do. Like, for instance, no one did a gunpowder residue test on DJ's hands. No one did fingerprinting on the firearm that they said killed DJ. I asked the ME, did you measure the arm span of DJ to see if he could pull a trigger in a downward motion while he was sitting down in the chair? She said no. So all of these things led me believe that they did a shoddy investigation. So with that in mind, I then went and met with the ME and presented evidence that she did not have. And the evidence that she didn't have, by looking at the police report, I went and tracked down witnesses who were in the house. Both of them were in jail, and I went to the different jails and I interviewed them, and both of them had different stories, but the main part of the story was DJ did not have the gun in his hand. So let me explain. One person stated that this guy, a person of interest, had the gun at DJ's head and was trying to threaten him and scare him. And then the gun mistakenly went off. He said he didn't think the guy was trying to kill DJ, but he thought that he was trying to intimidate him by putting the gun to his head, and maybe he didn't know that the gun was loaded. That was his story. Another person said that the person of interest, she saw him walk towards DJ, hold the gun to his head, and pull the trigger. So when I say both of their stories were different, they were, but what stayed consistent was DJ never had the gun in his hand and pulled the trigger. That's suicide. anyone who brings a gun into the picture is homicide. Now, I couldn't tell you if it was murder. I couldn't tell you if it was manslaughter. That's not my, you know, that's not my realm to decide that. But what I can tell you is DJ didn't take the gun, point it in the downward motion on the left side of his face when he's right-handed and pull the trigger and shoot himself in the face. I'm 100% certain of that. Okay. So the ME didn't have that part of the investigation. The ME didn't have that the person of interest failed a polygraph test, which we all know a polygraph test can't be used in court. But you do a polygraph test to kind of guide you in the right direction on who has, you know, for your investigation. So she didn't have that. So all of these things, she ruled suicide not having the full investigation. And the crime scene pictures clearly showed that the crime scene was tainted. The firearm was on the porch. It wasn't left in this resting place where it should have been. There were no blood spatters. You can see in the trash can in one of the pictures that there was blood, like somebody tried to clean something up. So the whole crime scene was tainted. The police gave authorization to destroy the chair where DJ was found. So nothing was tested. Nothing was done correctly. So that whole situation, the ME did not have any of the facts, but still rooted a suicide.
In March of 2017, investigators submitted the case to the district attorney. In April, the prosecutor declined to press charges.
They actually called us in April of 2017 and told us that they wasn't pressing charges, and that they were going to put it into a pending status in case someone ever confessed. And after that, we knew that it was over on their part. And after that, I had actually got the case closed because as long as it was in a pending status, I couldn't get any of the files. So I had to get the case closed so I could get all the files and all the information, because in order to do anything about it, I had to know everything about it. And that's what I continue to tell my mom to this day. She tells me I don't need to look at things, I don't need to read these things, and I tell her, in order to do anything about it, I have to know every detail about it.
In a letter to investigators, District Attorney Herbert E. Franklin wrote, "After a review of the evidence gathered in your thorough investigation into the death of Donald Fickey Jr., which occurred on October 3, 2016 in Walker County, it appears there's insufficient evidence to bring criminal charges to bear against anyone in connection with this death. While certain statements made by witnesses, when viewed in isolation, would tend to indicate a homicide, the physical evidence and the other witness statements support a conclusion that the death was a suicide. As the weight of the evidence supports the conclusion that the death was a suicide, this matter will be considered closed. In the unlikely event that further evidence comes to light, please do not hesitate to contact this office. Thank you for your hard work and efforts in this matter." The first goal for Amanda and her private investigator is to overturn the medical examiner's ruling of suicide. With the death ruled a suicide, it would be incredibly difficult to bring this to court. The medical examiner's office is extremely reluctant to change their ruling, as admitting a mistake may open them up to additional challenges. This is where the private investigator comes in.
I was hired to, I guess in layman's terms, to see about getting what evidence and what information that I can find or discover or whatever to get it changed from a suicide to a homicide, and then take that to the district attorney so he can take the case to the grand jury to see if they issue a true bill. So my job is to get justice. I'm not saying the DA should go out there and just arrest them. What I am saying is the DJ should take the evidence to a grand jury. That's the purpose of a grand jury, to see if there's enough evidence for a true bill, which I know that there is. And the reason I know that, because that county has made arrests on a lot less evidence than what they have now in this particular case.
As I listened to Amanda's story and read through the documents she sent me, I couldn't help but wonder if DJ's death investigation would have gone differently if he wasn't a drug addict, and if he wasn't found in a drug house. Amanda was told by the investigators that they were there to be DJ's voice, but she worries that he was written off as just another drug addict off the streets. Private investigator Eric Eccles echoes this.
The DA didn't think that DJ had a loving family and was not going away. DJ lived in a trap house. I mean, they did drugs at this trailer. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the crime scene photos, but the trailer itself was a mess. I mean, it was just food and debris and clothes and just all kind of garbage just on the floor and everywhere in the trailer. I mean, the trailer was just, it was just nasty. And they did not think that DJ had a loving family, and he does. And it doesn't matter to me if you're a drug addict or whatever. What's right is right, and what's wrong is wrong. They are wrong. DJ's case needs to go to the grand jury.
As we've heard before, investigating a loved one's death is a burden, and it's one that takes a toll.
I'm bearing the weight of the world on my shoulders because I have seen things, read things, heard things, listened to things that I should never have had to hear about my brother's death. But all because somebody didn't want to do a job, their own job, you know. And I keep it from the rest of my family because I try to protect them from that information because I don't want them to know the details of what happened to him. It's killing me. I can't sleep. I've been diagnosed with depression, obviously, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder. Even the medicine that they give me to help me sleep doesn't help. I get a couple hours sleep a night, if that. I mean, it's awful.
Amanda is a baker making custom cakes from her home, and she went from being booked up months in advance to only doing a few orders here and there for family and friends because in her grief, the depression makes her not feel motivated to keep her business going. She puts her energy into keeping her depression from affecting one person in her life, her 7-year-old daughter.
I mean, it's a struggle every day just to get out of the bed, but you know, I didn't want her life to change or be affected from that because we've always been active with her in doing, you know, she's always involved in something, sports and activities, you know, gymnastics, cheerleading. I've always kept her into things like that. And we've always took her on weekend trips or to the zoo or aquarium and stuff like that. So I didn't want her life to change or be affected from, because I'm so depressed. So it's even a bigger struggle to have to do that, you know, because I don't want her to suffer from my depression.
But with Eric Eccles on her side, things are looking up.
Almost a year after my brother was killed, before I could get anybody to listen to me, I had begged the media to, you know, do a story on it, to investigate it. I have emailed congressmen, the governor. I have emailed any person and every person possible, called people, went to their offices. Nobody would listen. They all thought I was crazy. I was making it up. There was no way that law enforcement would do something like that because everybody wants to assume, oh, well, he killed himself and they just don't want to accept it. No, that's not the case. So he was a godsend. He stuck with me through this whole time, and he's not giving up. The more they're running him around just like they did me, and the more they run him around, then the more headstrong he is to do something about it. He has gotten a lot more documents. I can't release those yet. He's also got us an attorney. So things are progressing. It's not progressing as fast as I would like it to, but I'm having patience because I see things are progressing.
As Eric pointed out to me in our conversation, people may plan for life insurance for a funeral, but they never plan and never save in the event they need a private investigator under these circumstances. Eric has written and self-published a book about a case he previously worked on, the defense of Tanya Kraft. Tanya Kraft was a kindergarten teacher in Georgia who was accused of molesting her own daughter and two of her daughter's friends. She was eventually acquitted of all counts, and experts looking at the reports of what the children have disclosed during interviews noticed quite a few changes in their stories, and many believe the children were coached. Eric uses the money from his book sales as what he calls an indigent investigation fund. It doesn't necessarily make up for his hourly rate, but it does cover his expenses. If you're interested in purchasing his book, it's called The Eccles Files, Catoosa County Justice, and the link to order the book will be in the show notes. To pay for Eric's expenses, particularly his travel to meet with witnesses and investigators as they're willing, Amanda has done everything she can.
I worked a deal out with her. I bought my own book. I bought 50 copies or two cases or whatever of my own book. And I sent it to her, to Amanda. And she went out and sold the book for cash. And that's how she paid for me. You know, I said, look, this is how we'll do it. She said she got a lot of people up there in Alabama and the mountains or whatever who wants to support. And I said, well, just tell them to buy a book. Well, they didn't have credit cards. So I said, you know what? I don't know you, but I'm going to trust you. I'm going to send you a case of books and you sell them. And she said, that's what, yep, you do that. And I got people ready to buy them. And she sold the books. And then she sent me the money. She has done donut sales, cake sales, cookie sales. I mean, she's done all of these different things to get money for whatever.
In all of this, no one has forgotten DJ's little ones. His son just had a birthday, another one without his father. The children still live with Amanda's mother and visit Amanda often.
And they came down the other day, because they only live a couple houses up from me. And they came down the other day, and they seen one of his pictures hanging on the wall, and one of the little girls said, that's my daddy. And then I have another picture on the table, and I showed it to her and asked her who that was, and she said, that's my daddy. And I told her, I said, can you give him a kiss? And she kissed him, and she said, I love you, daddy. And it's so hard to see those babies doing things like that. And asking for their daddy. The babies aren't, the twins aren't as bad right now because I think they were just so young, they're not going to remember him very much. They remember him because of the pictures and the stories we tell them. But the little boy, he remembers his daddy. And he'll ask for his daddy, I want my daddy. I want to see my daddy. Where's my daddy? And it breaks their heart. I show him pictures of him, and I'll tell him, well, this was Easter. You know, we hit Easter eggs this day, and we had a big dinner, and this was the Halloween dress-up party that we had, and your daddy dressed up as this. I mean, I show him pictures and everything, trying to keep his memory in their head.
This case is still recent, and Amanda and her family are still early on in their grieving and healing process. In talking to Amanda, I can see there is still more pain than hope. But with the help of her private investigator and increased media coverage of the case, perhaps we can get those scales to tip the other way. I will be out of town off and on over the next several weeks. So Impact Statement will be going on an every other week release schedule going forward. If you are interested in sharing your story on Impact Statement, please email impactstatementpod@gmail.com. On the next Impact Statement.
You know, you always tell your kids, stay away from strangers, you know, don't talk to strangers because they could be not nice people. But how do you tell your kid to deal with this, because Justin wasn't a stranger. He was actually a very close friend of Eric's. So that was something that I think they struggled with.